listening to Atoms, Motion, and the Void. The Fingerprints of the Fallen Down. A Metaphysical Murder Mystery. Part 1. The Whippoorwill to Paradox. There is a fellow who lives around the back of everything here in Lemon. Russ Taylor, his name might be, though I have heard it spoken Truss Railer and T. Russ Tyler, or even Tom Timmons. These could be a series of other different gentlemen, unknown to me, making use of the nearby names, yet I am not alone in my fender bender as far as his nomination. I have heard others remark, that lunatic Russ Taylor, or Truss Tyler, or whatever it is, pulled out my marigolds and put in one of his whippoorwills. And indeed, that is almost all there is to know about Russ Taylor. His name is rubble, his marbles have rolled away. He pulls flowers from the earth and installs homemade whippoorwill clocks in their place. While not chronometers of the ticking variety, they do tell time and evidently have other special secret uses beyond horology. Russ Taylor makes no claims about his clocks. He has never, to my knowledge, taken responsibility for them. He did not originally name them, nor yet does he hide his hobby as much as refuse to discuss it. He is a tall and ragged man, with long arms and a face full of lines. As to the clocks themselves, each is a feather bound to a stick, bound to a rock. Of these, the stick is the most generic. It can be pine or birch or elm, as long as it is wand-like and dry. But the feather is always from a whippoorwill, and the stone is always from the river. Altogether, the contraption looks as though a child had attempted to make a sailboat that could also swiftly double as a tomahawk. While I know the basic functions, I have never learned their principles and cannot therefore make any use of the whippoorwills myself. Apparently, one simply observes the feather's shadow as it points toward one of the 12 scratches on the stone, with each mark being the scrawled representative of one of the 12 hours. But the scratches are randomly etched in a senseless pattern that looks on the dark stone like shooting stars in the night. By moonlight, the 12 scratches evidently mature and serve as stand-ins for the different months. And the way the shadow falls across whatever monthly scratch further provides evidence of the exact day itself. These operations are mutually exclusive. Thus, during the day you may discover the general hour, but not the month or day. At night, you may gather the exact date, but not the time. Evidently, there is also a way to learn what year it is, if one has somehow forgotten, using the shadow thrown by the tip of the generic stick this time, rather than the feather. Around the edge of the stone is a winding symbology that, need I say it, makes no visible sense to me, but which hieroglyphs are useful in the various arcane functions, including the fact of the year. Rumours of the whippoorwill clock's uncommon use have cast into the distance, and now pull a small but steady crowd of oddly dressed strangers to stand in our flower beds here in Lemon. Whatever occult use they make of the clocks, their secret is kept, like a prohibition password, reserved only for those whose wobbled souls clearly demonstrate an allegiance to moonshine. It is a witch-like community of enthusiasts that seeks out the mysterious whippoorwills, is what I mean, in long robes and funny hats and dirt in their pockets. Not myself being a witch or wizard, despite frequently bearing loam in my cotton envelopes, and always with a funny hat on my head, still I am kept in the dark, and not in the know. Then again, I have never been in the know. I have never driven to the know, or even had the know vaguely pointed out. I believe I may have been born in the honey light of the know, but departed soon after, for parts both dark and unknown. Regardless, it is easy to guess that these shady visitors, who wear handmade blankets and smell of sweet smoke, use the clocks in the service of spells, or ghosts, or futurism. As might be expected, the full brigade of human feeling has been aimed at the clock's inventor, Russ Tyler. In town, both he and his whippoorwills are points of charm and misery. His clocks are beloved, considered works of art, believed sacred of the earth, ingenious, oracular, a fundamental discovery, a way forward. They are also deemed ugly, malignant, demonic, a blight, useless snake oil, and, to a small contingent, somehow pornographic. Russell himself is either a saint or the devil. There is some harmony as far as the state of his sanity, that he has none. Everyone agrees that his deck of cards has been dealt to the wilds. In the gentle story of his madness, it is also widely believed that he suffered a precipitating, long-ago loss, a kind of breakage from which he could not, nor could anyone, the sweet legend allows, recover. So those are his clocks, and that is him. I describe this in detail because my latest small errand arrives by way of a recent accidental discovery of a whippoorwill clock in a field of pansies, which clock I would surely have overlooked had there not been a violent emission of gunfire from the nearby forest. I suppose I had been daydreaming as well, deep down and swimming my fathoms. In my startled defense, I ducked so swiftly down that I toppled into the fuzzy arms of the underclover. And there it was, lodged in the dirt, a whippoorwill clock. From the regrowth of the flowers, I guessed that the clock must have been there for some time, years perhaps. I brushed myself off, panned the forest for signs of the hunter, and then stared at the clock for a while, wondering, as I always do when I come upon one, if I might have somehow acquired the knack of it. And in fact, this time, it seemed I had. What I saw disturbed me greatly, for the middle morning sun upon the feather had cast an inky shadow that pointed directly at the number 79 on the circumference symbology, 79 being my current age. When I kneeled closer to make sure of the number, I discovered only a myriad of scratches. On both feet, directly overhead, the inscription of numerals came into focus, but the slightest movement to one side dissolved the 79 into a blurry mess, a kind of optical illusion that required an exact perspective. I felt certain that I had at last made some headway into perceiving the clock at work, but what sort of mechanism of the flowers, one so reliant on shadows and scratches, could offer anyone a truth related to anything numbered 79. Into my head, the witches and wizards crept and whispered, and I suddenly had the remotest chill that whippoorwill clocks might be used to conjure the date of one's own death. For if the 79 was not personal, not meant for me, what could it otherwise mean? 79 confounded what's? As Russ Traynor was unavailable due to travelling marbles, I knew at once that I would have to pay a visit to Lemon's great gossip and busiest busybody, old flower-dusted Amelia Bloombird, who could in some ways serve as the unauthorized biographer of every citizen in town.
I thought surely I would not find it again. How I was wrong, it is as fateful as sin. This feeling that I belong to something in some way, till the end, and I am making an effort to stay. With you here, it has been easy to say that I could never lose sight of what my heart truly is. But the moment you step away, I am forced to look in and face all the things that I've ever been without you. It is true at times one can see I am strong. I am not at home, yet I know where I belong. I am silence now, but I am always song. Can you hear me? This time last year I'd be dead. It's quite strange the thoughts that pop into your head when you're busy smiling, surrounded by your closest of friends. It is impossible to escape the sound of the dark that is following around. But I just go for a walk in my mind, and the light can be found. And the moment I step away, you are forced to look in and face all the things that you've ever been without me. It is true. Times one can see you are strong. You are not at home, yet you know where you belong. You are silence now, but you are always song. I can hear you.
There's no different way there but straight on. Amelia Bloombird, Smells of Pencils. This distracts me no end. From an apt distance I have circled, scanning her blue bonnet dress for signs of pencil peelings or graphite slugs. I have inquired broadly of her job history, her hobbies. But in fact, I can find no evidence that she even owns a single one. She doesn't keep a postal correspondence, she has no journal, does no sketching, and she despises crosswords. She was never a school teacher. Her handwriting is crooked fence abysmal, and I can imagine there are long stretches where she goes without writing a single word. She lives, apparently without pencils, in her retirement, in a small yellow farmhouse, the miserable bright ochre of pencils. Over the years I've casually remarked to various grandees of her sweet schoolmarm smell of freshly baked Ticonderogas, but I can get no confirmation. Smells of pencils, I might say, leadingly. But to this, no matter the great care I take with such invitations, and as firmly as I push against the figurative shoulder of old so-and-so, no one will take the bait. No one denies it, no one confirms it, no one will even give a sign that they've heard my accusation. Is it an impolite wonder? Can inquiries related to a person's strong pencil fragrance go unheard? Regardless of her scent, Amelia Bloombird is an omnipresent and almost omniscient citizen. Daily seen by all, as the sun, in her bonnet dress, with flat ribbons laid across her shapeless bumble of silver hair. She attends everything, visits all the shops, and talks to more people in a day than I do in a year. Her information is at the core of a life in a small town. Who has died, who is ailing, who has gotten drunk and done the irredeemable, who has said completely sober the unforgivable, who is going out of their mind, who is failing at finances, and which families are falling to pieces. Like T. Ross Traylor, she is a divider of the town's sympathies. There are those who cross the street when they spy her. There are those who, tired of her ubiquity, call out, "Go home, Amelia Bloombird." Actually, those who do not like her call her Agatha Birdbath, and so rather say, "Go home, Agatha Birdbath," as this stingy shift is considered somehow demeaning. Yet she is a prime source, a water main. She is the first person anyone will seek out when anything happens, from a murder to a lark. When news strikes, it strikes within her catchment, before her, from her, toward her, in her general direction. She trades in this information and keeps a stall of purest air in the center of town. But you must give before you get. There must be payment. You must share with her that which is likely semi-private, full well knowing she will spread it outward, your intimacy a sudden public fire. As I made my way into Lemon, I rifled through my own barren store of potential gossip to be used in trade. I had only a few old tin cans to barter. I knew that Miles McIntosh was not well, but then again he was 97 years old. I knew that Avis Hearn had burned down her chicken coop by accident through the secret of her expensive cigar habit. I knew that the police had begun some small investigation into the fire, as apparently Avis had insured the chicken coop multiple times through different agencies and stood to gain some little profit from her loss. I knew firsthand that she was deeply embarrassed by it all, the accident, the financial windfall. She was especially worried that her secret smoking habit would get about, and that people would learn she was keeping the chickens inside her home now. Yet a story that pitted chickens against cigars made it likely that Amelia Bloombird already knew it, and better than I. However, I have always managed to be hopeful, without the requirement of any reason. Coming down the tree-lined hill into the brick and glass town centre, there is always a mysterious warm wind, as though the village engines were hard at work and sending forth our gathered breath. I glanced along the street and without any effort spied her where I imagined, centre stage in the village green, seated on a bench like a retired queen. A very old woman nestled beside her in the spinning thrall of fresh gossip. I entered the green and waited at a distance for the older woman to be done with her session. I observed Amelia in the interim. She has a soft, egg-like shape, a large watermelonish head, her face dusted in white flour. Again, one can make no headway into the meaning of this. Is she a baker? Is this her form of makeup or some medicinal powder? No one will tell me. At her topmost, she wears the least popular hairstyle in town. It is known as the Bloombird, and women may be heard at the parlour saying with a laugh, "As long as it's not a Bloombird, I'm sure I'll like it." The Bloombird being a sort of wig upon a similar wig look of puffy white piles of not very realistic hair. She has large, turtle-like hands, which seem incapable of fine work. Again, both hands dusted with flour. Her main features continue this trend. Large, smooth, dusted, and shell-like. As though instead of a nose, she wore the small container for a nose. Instead of lips, she had a queer double casement. As the older woman stood, a slow process of stiff hips and tired elbows. Amelia shifted her eyes around the park, looking for her next client, as it were. Spotting me, loitering, dunce-like beneath a lamp, she nodded and drew me toward her, and as I approached, she stood, as though this was some prearranged and formal meeting that required international notions of polity. I prepared to shake hands and readied my expression, but her arm did not extend. We'd known each other for many years, of course, but I couldn't recall the last time we'd spoken. She was that sort of local celebrity whom one often observes over the shoulders of others. I had eavesdropped on her weekly, if not daily, but rarely conversed with her directly. I therefore had the obstacle of this prefigurement to overcome, as though talking with a person of historical value, like Emily Dickinson or Abraham Lincoln. Amelia's quite unlike either of these enigmas, but Emily and Abraham are the historical figures I rely on in such moments of reference. "Sit," she said, in the take-charge manner of a psychic who instinctively senses a clumsy new customer. "How are things, Sherwin?" she said, to hobble us along. It wasn't a question, and her tone was playful. She was making mild fun of my awkwardness, which, teasing again, was meant to soften me. "Very good, Amelia," I said, and smiled. It really was ridiculous, the trouble I was having. "I have just come from the Menson Fields," I said. "Hunting season, I hope you're keeping safe. The bullets are flying, but are the pansies still in their colour?" Amelia asked. She had a trying conversational mode of linking on alike fragments. "The bullets are flying above the brightest flowers. The bullets are flying above the brightest flowers," I said, as an old admiral might, peering through binoculars at hills exploding in reds and yellows. I felt obligated to responsibly dispatch all of her inquiries. After a moment, I persevered independently. "I found by accident one of Russell's whippoorwills," I said, "in the pansies, a few years old, I imagine." "I didn't know he kept one up there, but surely you have a vest," Amelia said, pleased to have gained this small bit of information. Her eyes shifted to one side, as though she were adjusting the topography of the map of Lemon she kept in her mind. "I have never been able to read the clocks," I said, "and I sadly have no protective orange vest. But I'm curious about them. The clocks, I mean." "Very mysterious, very hard to learn, very few know how," Amelia said. She stared at me, unblinking. I needed to deposit my penny here. "Avis Herne," I began. Amelia tisked. "So sorry to hear about her coop, but then again cigars. There's a lesson for us there." "Is there?" I said. "For all of us, you think?" "Miles McIntosh?" I queried the air. No, Amelia said, distastefully. "Was there something about this particular whippoorwill that caught your interest?" she asked. I shifted with discomfort. The intimacy I wished to avoid sharing was my experience with the clock. I did not relish the idea of the town knowing my susceptibility to omens. "I mean, we've had whippoorwills around us for years," she pressed. "Hardly anyone knows or cares how to use them. Why the sudden interest, one wonders?" My heart dropped. She had set her price. She leaned her eggness toward me, almost flirtatiously. A light skiff of powder tumbled from her cheek into the air as a kind of mini-cloud between us. The smell of pencils was stronger than ever. "Very well," I said with a sigh, and surrendered. I told her quickly and as painlessly as I could. My only narrative problem was that I kept imagining her paying it forward. "A rare visit from Sherwin Sleeves," I could hear her saying. "Ran into a bit of a whippoorwill in Merson's pansy field. If I wrote obituaries, I'd get my pencil sharpened. 79, he saw, and not wearing a vest, and hunting season, and gunfire in all such places where he goes. When I was done, Amelia swallowed and turned her head to a side, once more assimilating these articles of confession into her massive archive. Finally, she set a powdered turtle hand on mine. There's only one thing to do, and it won't be easy at all, but I'd be curious of your search if search you do, she said. A number of years back, we had a visitor from New York, from the town of Lily Pond. A lot of witches from Lily Pond, if you didn't know, but none that stayed, as Helen Eleanor did. She came looking for T. Russell himself, not his clocks, mind you, but the man himself, wanting to study the making of his dials and his own brand of mischief. What came of that I don't know, but she's the only one, aside from him, who can tell you how they go and what way to read them. I had heard the name before, read in the Lemon Times about a Helen Eleanor. She had gone missing some years back and a formal search undertaken, but the story had gone strange. She was living in the forest. She had moved there, squatting in the wilds. Apparently this is not impossible or illegal under certain circumstances in the right spots. But I had no idea what she looked like or where in the wilderness such things were permitted. She's the one that does the homemade chairs, of course, which is the only way to find her, Amelia said in conclusion. The chairs, I said, and at once a long-standing other mystery snapped into its solving. I had long wondered, without being able to remember to ask around, who it might be that was leaving the curious, rough pine chairs and benches all around the forest. Does she really? I said. I have two on my mountain, one on the eastern trickle and a bench on the high cliffs. I use them both. Her most recent chair is near the summit of Paradox Mountain, Amelia said. She's known to make more heavy use of her most recent chairs. I stood up and bowed slightly. To Paradox Mountain, then, am I? I confirmed, rather more in the fashion of a pioneer than I wished. Tell me what you find. I shall want to know, Amelia said, her eyes sharpening with requirement. A full report. Is she filthy, dirty-faced, the raggedness of her clothes, of the intactness of her mind? What's on her feet, and what in the world has she been eating all these years?
You're a crazy acrobat. You're the witch, I am your cat. I want to be a bit like you. I hope you don't mind if I do. I love the way your body's made. I love the way your voice is sex. To be the whisper upon your ear, I want to be the bed you made. Made into life. take a walk, and all the things that you see with your eyes, oh, to be that distant thought, some growing meaning in your mind. I
From the perspective of downtown Lemmon, one can see Paradox Mountain in the western air above the river in the form of two very neat isosceles triangles. Two mountains with a sharp valley between them. Study the ridge, and you will note what is often noted, that the interceding dale is like the collapsed peak of a much larger, much more wonderful mountain, that if you propped the absence up, it would turn the two small mountains into one remarkable peak. Thus the creature that is Paradox Mountain is actually two mountains connected, more or less, by the story that they should be a third, taller, single mountain. But the intransigence of that which isn't but seems, in this case, makes that which is quite not. The one mountain paradox is the author of the more practical paradox, which is that no one ever really found a way of clearly denoting the separate summits, one from the other. If one wanted to meet on top of Paradox Mountain, there is no sure-footed way of defining which summit is meant. Some call the mountain on the left, as viewed from downtown Lemmon, Left Paradox, and the one on the right, Right Paradox. Some call them Paradox 1 and Paradox 2, but those more cartographically inclined call the one that is left East Paradox and the one right West Paradox. The only relief from this, I suppose, is the huge lack of enthusiasm for Paradox Mountain itself, which indifference in part stems from the problem that it seems like a great old hotel whose roof has collapsed. My journey would be approximately 4 hours in one direction, 2 hours to the trailhead, and 2 hours to the top. So 8 hours altogether, there and back. With my departure time of 10 a.m., I could get home from Left East Paradox 2 as the sun set behind Right West Paradox 1. I headed across the trestle onto the wide spill of Old Main Road. I followed Old Main to Out of Town Road before bearing sharply left onto the undrivable but pleasant Paradox Road. There were plenty of warning signs at the front, meant to bar the casual entrant. Road not maintained. Road not maintained for winter. Four-wheel drive advisory. Moose warning. Bear country. No gas next 30 miles. Paradox ahead. After a mile or so, and without any notice, the trails to the summits blend out left and right from Paradox Road. There is no sign here to mark the end of the road and the beginning of the trails, and rather these two roads slowly narrow and rise until the discovery is made by the traveller that he or she has begun hiking a mountain and has ceased traversing any roadway. It would only have confused matters had I asked Amelia which peak to climb. Regardless of her answer, left or right, east or west, one or two, I would not have trusted it. I would have to guess, and hope my guess was correct. I flipped a coin, the size of the moon, in my head, which directed me, by its dust, to the rightmost trail. The path makes a long pirouette around to the north side before beginning a series of sharp climbs. After 20 minutes, one gets to the broken switchbacks and the early previews of Loft. Somehow, without much effort, one has snuck up on a good height. After an hour, the granite facings become the main walking surface, and here and there on the steeps, one is obliged to take hold of a gnarly, scrubby tree to pull oneself onward. I took my time and allowed many rests, gazing out at the fog of green that is the distant wilderness and the nearly flavored clarity of blue that was the sky. I could see 100 nameless mountains in the distance, sleeping away their centuries, and not a single road or house. It was ancient times once more. It was life, pressed right to death, in the bright yellow kiss of the light. With the rough crest nearing, I moved slower, and stared for signs of one of Helen Eleanor's homemade chairs. In this search, I soon found myself at the mercy of the smallest bitter smell of smoke, and it was this, rather than the sight of her chair, that led me on. I came into a nervous crouch as a great wail of blue smoke crossed my path. I scanned for the fire which must be nearby. I had the sense that Miss Eleanor would run off, like a fabled creature, at the first sign of civilization. To the east was the unfolded grey extension of a promontory. At its furthest peninsula there stood a small, decorative tree, black and dangled against the blue sky. The stony peak of the summit swung above me so close I felt I could touch it. The wind was restless sharks and cool, darting this way and that. Mountains always have the exciting feeling of acrobats. I waited for the air to quiet, that the smoke might perform better from its location. And then, as sight had fallen to scent, so scent fell to sound. It was during just such a lull of winds that I heard faint music twinkling toward me from the area of the peninsula. It had the spooked but merry sound of a song played underwater. I crossed off the trail and dropped for a moment into a small section of forest before coming out onto the promontory. I stepped over the grassy fairway between the statuary of boulders and small bushes, beneath the drooping tree at the peninsula's tip. Someone appeared to be sleeping, Rip Van Winkle style, with the unattractive, splayed look of great fatigue. Now, instead of smoke, I could smell the grimy works of mineral spirits and oils, the sweet clay fragrance of paint. On a stone much nearer was the source of the music, a drowsily spinning old Victrola playing a sun-warped Eddie Cantor record. I suddenly had the feeling of being watched, and cupped my brow to see if the distant sleeper had come alert. "Are you the police?" a soft voice called. I thought at first it was some artifact from the Eddie Cantor, but then there was a grey shifting right before my eyes, and I noticed with shock that there was someone not 10 yards away from me, hidden, but only slightly, behind a juniper. The woman did not stand, but stabbed the bristles of her brush against a canvas, whose ash and jungle tones blended perfectly into the scenery. Indeed, the woman's dust-brown outfit and auburn silver hair were an absolute camouflage to the stone and grass. I took a step toward her painting, until I saw what I now expected, a handmade chair of fresh birch. "The police," I repeated. The woman tossed her brush into a tin of solvent and stood. She was nearly my height, not quite 70, and completely handsome, like a librarian gone quite wild. Green eyes observed me over awkward spectacles that looked as though they were made of wood. There were streaks of paint across her cheeks. "Helen Eleanor," I guessed. She smiled slightly in a way that meant she would not confirm so private a thing. "Shall we go to her now?" she said. "Shall we go to who?" I said. "You are Sheriff Ray," she said more than asked. I'm assuming you got my message. I apologize for the eccentricity of the smoke, but I do what works for me, and I have no phone. I am not, and I did not, I said. My name is Show and Sleeves, and I am here looking for you, I believe, if you are Helen Eleanor. The woman stopped and put both hands on her hips. She went absolutely still, and in her stillness seemed to shrink, as though great thought had the power to contract her entire being. You were not drawn here because of the gypsy smoke? She asked. The gypsy smoke, well, I said. The smoke did draw me here, I suppose. I could smell it, and so, in some ways, yes. There was now in me a wooziness, a striking inability to follow that which had only just preceded. Time felt suddenly shuffled, as though the moment yet to come were being slid behind the moment that just was. I had the sneaking suspicion that something was terribly wrong inside me, and yet the very mechanism which judged such things had itself been shut down. Well, you must be here to help summon the police in some way, then, she said with some satisfaction. These smoke charms have a way of inventing their own solutions. Smoke charms, I said. Or had I said it? The light pulsed around her head and then darkened. Do you have a phone? She asked. I suppose that would be fine, one of those phones that everyone has. She made a strange crocodile motion with her hands. A cell phone, I guessed, but not from her sign language. Yes, exactly. No, I said. I mean, I do have one, but I don't. I struggled to imagine where it might be. I felt my pockets. Sometimes it was accidentally there, though almost always out of power. She grabbed her chin and tugged it. Peculiar, curious, and reversed, she said in a rolling way. It was her form of a puzzled curse. Maybe if you looked at the painting, it might help, she suggested. She waved me toward it, and I struggled over my smoke-charmed legs. What do you see? She asked. What I saw in paint was roughly what there was on the peninsula, the tree, the figure, the promontory stretching into the blue sky. It was obvious that she was more than an amateur, and had found her voice in such composition. The sound rough strokes from the large brush and the dirty swirls of colour had an attractive, bruising way of making the scene by way of vague and slovenly forms. The tree was a blotch of brown mottles. The grey and yellow figure, sleeping at the base of it, was made of a single stroke. What is that red spot? I said, pointing at the forehead of the sleeper where my eye was drawn. I had no idea myself when I painted it. What do you make it out to be? She asked. I rather wished it was a cycloptic eye, but the jagged edge with its tiny speck of black made it look exactly like a bullet hole. I didn't say this, but Helen nodded, as though perceiving my chain of struggled thoughts. I'm not feeling so well, I said. It's the smoke, she confirmed. It has a mild narcotic effect. You needn't worry about it. Let's move closer to her until you see it. All of my senses were on the decline, and my stomach was churning. The woman in wooden glasses led me along the grass and stonework of the peninsula. My eyes flooded abstractly with light and shadow, losing their instinct for focus. Who is it there? I asked. A stranger, she said. But even if I'd known once, I wouldn't now. I've forgotten who you are already, she said. I am Sean Sleeves, I said, slurring now like a drunk. And I have already forgotten it again, she said, smiling. I sort of gasped, I don't know why. I was on the verge of giving her my name again when she stopped me. Oh, no, she said, as though a name were not something she could ever stand. Please don't. My foot kicked something heavy, and there was a sound of metal on rock. We both looked down at the black, L-shaped object. I wouldn't, but of course you are free to May, she said. Free to May? I echoed. What sort of language did she speak? What is it? I asked, and felt as though I were reaching my arm into the sea. It's the smoke, I'm quite sure, Helen said.
What sort of smoke is it that I've got?
I wondered. It's the gypsy smoke I sent out for Sheriff Ray, to fetch him, but it has fetched you instead. I looked into my hand.
It is none other than a gun, I said, with more slurring.
I felt a mix of misery and half-delight. Helen, if that is who she was, shook me that the gun depart my fingers, but I held it tight, a treasure that I shouldn't want to lose.
I need you to contact Sheriff Ray, the woman said, very clearly and very loud.
I was slouching somewhat against her.
Have I been poisoned? I asked. Of course not. You are simply helping me, helping us, all three of us. Now concentrate.
She propped me up before her. As I tipped back, she pushed her fingertips against my spine in a peculiar rhythm that calmed and decreased my delirium.
Can you still see? She asked.
Yes, I said. A cold wave fell and rose in convergent crispness through me now. The sense of confusion lifted. I stood into my bones more solidly.
Well, it's Avis Herne, I said, happy to see the old chicken owner before me.
My smile quickly darkened. Avis lay beneath the tree, clearly dead, with a terrible hole between her eyes. I jogged to her side and touched her cold hand. The flesh was soft, but gone of life. A single trickle of blood had run down the bridge of her nose to unsettlingly drip into her open mouth. The blood had continued to pool there until done. It was ghoulish. I wanted to close her mouth, to clean it of the blood, to wipe her forehead and cover the small vacancy of the hole.
I am so sorry, Avis. I whispered to her and touched her jacket in a kind of affectionate tug.
I thought of her chickens clucking in dark rooms stashed with unsmoked cigars. I repeated my warm murmurs and sympathies until I felt a nervous buzzing against my right knee. I looked down at the shaking electronic square of Avis's cell phone. It bounced against me like a hungry baby bird. I picked it up. It felt lighter than air and lifted my arm into the sky. I struggled to keep hold of it, then battled it back down. I opened the shaking phone and squashed the buttons until I heard a voice.
Avis, the voice said, Sheriff again. I'm sorry, but more bad news about the chickens.
Sheriff, I said. I burst into tears from the poison of the smoke and the fact of poor Avis's death. I was on Paradox Mountain, I told him. Avis Herne was dead. I had found the murder weapon, an L-shaped gun at the bottom of the sea. It was in my very hand, and I would keep it safe. I told him that the phone was floating away, and he should come quick. That a certain enchantment of gypsy smoke had done me in. That I was in a kind of trance, and should be forgiven. That Helen Eleanor had done a painting from the distance, and through purest accident had painted the bullet hole, that I would be her alibi in this, if ever it was needed. The phone fell from my hand and floated slowly upward into the branches of the tree, where it stuck. I lay down to sleep beside poor Avis. If I had had a cigar, I would have slid it into her hand. A diamond came to my eye and warmed into a tear, and fell down my cheek with the feeling of a scratch. Avis so would have enjoyed a fine cigar to hold. I could even light it.
Sheriff says we mustn't move, I called out to Helen.
The words sloshed against my jaw.
That we should consider ourselves, as free as we are, under arrest for the moment.
Before shutting down, I let my eyes swim over the scene. The Victrola was gone, the painting and easel removed. Helen Eleanor and her wooden spectacles had vanished. There was no smoke or chair or music now, just the sound of the lullaby breeze as the peninsula cut notes from the larger winds. I tightened my grip on the gun and then took Avis's cigarless hand in mine, and we too traveled off into the slumber of other kingdoms, with castles as different and similar as the two summits of Paradox Mountain.
Laying down my armor and send me to sleep like a boat on the harbor and a horse cows and sea. There's a boy in the mountain laying down in the stars, and the one with my heart lost a heart to the war. Listen more, can I silently whisper to the wind and forget the sin? There's a boat on the river sinking just like a bird, falling just like a stone in the sky like the river. There's a boy in the mountains laying down in the dirt. Maybe he's dying, but it's her that he's hurt. Will I listen more? Can I silently whisper to the wind and forget the sin?
You've been listening to Atoms, Motion, and the Void.